From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Gohatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Climate change denialists like to question scientific research, perhaps assuming that the general public won't connect the dots between increased carbon dioxide levels and a warming planet. But on the science of air pollution, there is no argument that can explain away what people see before their own eyes and what they experience with their own health. Air pollution is a global threat to human and planetary health, and it's also a problem that can be stopped with strong legislation. Unfortunately, in the current rush to deregulate industries, we could be turning back the clock on the progress we've made. My guest is Dr. Gary Fuller. He is an air pollution scientist at King's College London. He also writes the Pollution Watch series for The Guardian, and he joins me to discuss his new book. It's called The Invisible Killer, The Rising Global Threat of Air Pollution and How We Can Fight Back. Welcome to the program, Dr. Fuller.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So I was fascinated by reading some of the history of how we viewed pollution in the olden days, if you will. You're in London, and London is a city with a history of having really, really bad industrial pollution, which at one time was actually considered a good thing, a preservative, a protector against disease. Can you briefly give us that history lesson?
Yeah, that's right. London's been wrestling with its air pollution problems for centuries. There's writings from the 1600s where people have really found it difficult living in the city. London's air pollution problems are not just to do with industry. They were to do with just the sheer number of homes that were in the city burning coal for the most part. But oddly, at those times, people actually believed the air pollution was good for them. If you think back before the days of refrigeration, for instance, if you wanted to preserve meat or fish or something like that, then you would smoke it. And people actually wrote saying, thank goodness for the smoke in the air to protect us from things like the sulfur pollution.
How did that change then? How did we come to realize that that particulate matter in the air we breathe has a very serious health impact? And I imagine that that is what has then spurred some of the earliest regulations around air pollution.
Well, a lot of the early regulations were based around nuisance and were based around environmental impacts. You know, having a smelly factory next to you was deemed not to be a very good thing. And it's really surprising that it took us so long to realise the harm that air pollution was doing. It's not really to the 1952 smog in London that really we realised and took action for the first time. I mean, that was a horrible event. The city was shrouded in smog and fog for 5 or 6 days. And around 12,000 people died as a consequence. It's the worst peacetime disaster to strike the UK, and that really brought about a massive change.
So what are some of the laws that you cite in your book that shows that air pollution can be tackled? And of course, there have been laws for many, many years. We see many different cities around the world now struggling with smog, thinking of, you know, Mumbai, India, or Beijing, China, and of course, Los Angeles, where our program is based, that has had historically a terrible smog problem that it tried to deal with legislation, right?
That's right. I mean, you could ask at any time, there's kind of the world's cliched smoggy or polluted city. And for a long time, it was London until we introduced the Clean Air Acts that cleaned up the pollution that was coming from people's homes for the most part. Then I think the title probably shifted to Los Angeles, I'm afraid. And you wrestled with some really horrible air pollution that was much more modern than what we had in London. Your air pollution problems were caused through petroleum and through cars for the most part. So it's the transport in the city. You've done a fantastic job there. And the work that's been done in California is absolutely world leading. And now I think the title for the world's most polluted city has moved on again. It was Beijing, certainly, but now places like Delhi are really vying for truly the world's most polluted places.
What are the main sources of air pollution that need to be tackled? I mean, there are many, obviously. As you mentioned, vehicular emissions in places like Los Angeles, but then there's also factory pollution, right?
That's right. I mean, each place in the world has its own air pollution mixture, but often the sources are similar. So there's transport, there's the way in which we heat our homes, and we run our industry as well. And then one of the things that we often overlook is the air pollution that comes from outside the city. So for instance, Delhi last year has had tremendous pollution problems, and those aren't coming just from within the city. They're coming from agricultural burning in the area around it. London today, or just earlier on this week, was affected a lot by agricultural pollution. So it's not just the things that you might think of as the obvious ones.
What is agricultural pollution? I mean, when I think of industrial pollution, I'm thinking of coal burning plants, but we don't really think of agricultural pollution as a main source. What is that exactly?
No, we don't, which is why we haven't really tackled it sufficiently. I mean, I suppose the Delhi situation, what they have there is to improve the way in which the efficiency of their farming, if you like. A lot of it's become more mechanized, and with rice farming, for instance, the harvesting, mechanical harvesting, doesn't rip out all of the rice plants in the same way that it would be done by hand. Therefore, the farmers burn a lot of the stubble that's left. So I suppose that's quite an obvious pollutant. Less obvious is what comes from fertilizer, and what comes from animals and manure that's spread on land. So here in the UK, it's springtime, we've got flowers growing in the garden. Farmers are planting crops and they're putting their animals out for the first time because they keep them indoors for the most part in winter. And at the same time they do this, they're spreading the manure that was stored over winter and putting fertilizer onto the fields. And it's the ammonia from that that really damages our air pollution.
Is there a difference between animal agriculture and non-animal sort of, you know, produce that's grown? Because you often hear a sort of simplistic argument that if we want to take on things like climate change, we just need fewer people eating meat.
Yeah, we should all grow vegetarian for climate change. This is a slightly different issue, but also from the farmers. So it's not just whether you're farming animals or whether you're growing crops. It's really about the use of fertilizer and where the animal manure actually goes. So with better management, it's something that can be sorted out. From the farmer's perspective, though, if they go and put fertilizer on the field and the ammonia is then lost to the air, they're actually wasting money. So ways in which they can do it better are actually in their best interests as well.
Let's talk about one obvious aspect of the story, which is the impact to human health. I mean, I start picturing children struggling with asthma when we talk about air pollution, but it's a broader spectrum of health impacts than that, right?
Hugely. I mean, the best way to think about it is that air pollution is shortening our lives. If you live in London, then air pollution will shorten your life probably by around about 16 to 18 months. For most of the rest of the UK, it's similar. Our global figures are something of that order as well, perhaps 8-9 months or a year, or if you live in some of the most polluted places, several years. Now, people that die early through air pollution, if we found them in the streets, for instance, covered in green spots, then it would be really obvious that air pollution was the harmful agent. But when people die early through air pollution, they die through the diseases that they would die of normally anyway. So heart disease, respiratory disease, strokes, for instance. So there's no specific disease endpoints that you can point the finger and say, aha, that person died because of air pollution. It's just shortening their lives. So in that way, it's almost an invisible killer.
And hence the title of your book. So because does that then make it harder to make the case for strong legislation from all of these various air pollution sources, because it's not as clear how we connect the dots between air pollution and how it impacts human health. Does that stand in the way of progress?
Yes, it does. It's very difficult often to persuade the people that cause air pollution that they're doing harm and that they should spend money to remedy it. But if we don't do that, if you think about an industry, we used to think of an industry that, say, a town with factories with smoking chimneys as a sign of wealth. But in actual fact, it's a sign of subsidy, really. So the society and town and people around them are subsidizing that industry because the industry is not bearing the full cost of its impacts. The difficulty is, though, when you yourself are the polluter, it's easy to point at a factory or something like that and say they should do something about it. But when I say to you, you know, you might think about your driving habits, for instance, that's a harder argument to get across.
Let's talk about coal burning plants, which you alluded to earlier in terms of how London tackled its problems through the Clean Air Act. We have a, strangely enough, in 2018 and 2019, a revival, at least rhetorically, of coal burning as a source of energy in the United States for political reasons. Our president wants to ingratiate himself with coal miners and their representatives. Even though coal is a dying industry, how deeply impactful is it on our health, and how can legislation actually tackle it? I mean, can the coal, is there such a thing as clean coal, or do we sort of need to phase it out entirely if we actually care about human health?
I think it's a very good question. I mean, my wife's family come from a coal mining community, or former coal mining community, and the way in which those mines have now closed and the way in which it changes the industrial town that she comes from is a very real problem. But then on the other hand, the damage that's caused through burning coal is very, very real as well. So we've got examples of London in the 1950s. The solution then was for the most part to put in so-called smokeless coal and to move the industry out of the city. But we didn't really tackle the pollution. So that led to the acid rain problems that we experienced over Scandinavia. And you had similar issues in the US with your coal burning pollution going to Canada as well. It's a really dirty fuel, and it's very hard to burn it cleanly. It is possible, and we've shown this in Europe and in the US to some degree, but so much coal is being burnt around the world with very little emission controls. If you look at the problems that have been experienced in China, they're largely because of burning coal without any emission controls.
How important are scientific research and studies on this issue of tackling air pollution? Is there enough information? Is there enough research out there? Or are we at the point where we know enough and we have to stop trying to commission more studies and simply pour that effort into actually tackling the sources of pollution?
Yeah, I was called. I had to give evidence before the London Assembly a few years ago, and they asked me exactly the same question. They framed it slightly differently. When will we reach a point where we can be sure that there's enough evidence so that we need to do something about air pollution? And we passed that point years ago. The evidence that air pollution is harming our health and harms our environment as well, it is just completely overwhelming. So there's no reason not to act. We know also that in places where air pollution has been improved, and there's lots of examples of this around the world, we see benefits in health. There's lots of examples in the US as well. I mean, the Clean Air Program that you had that started in 1990 and is just running on to an end at the end of this decade. If you look at the amount of money spent by industry and the health burden that was saved, if you like, the US has got a sort of like 30 times greater return for its investment than it actually spent. So undoubtedly, it's a good thing to do.
Tell us about the six cities study that you describe in your book and why that was such an important study.
The six cities study had its 25th birthday just at the end of last year. If you think London in the 1950s told us that short-term smogs were really harmful to health, the six cities study taught us something entirely different. They didn't just look at short-term smogs. They studied the thousands of people, several thousand people, across six cities in the US for 14 or 15 years. And each year they wrote to them, basically sent them a postcard saying, "Are you dead yet?" And if they didn't get a reply, then they sent out an investigator to find out whether the person was still alive or what they'd died of. And they found people living in more polluted cities were dying sooner. And that told us that it's not just the air pollution we breathe during smogs, it's the air pollution that we breathe every day that's causing us most harm and shortening our lives. But that situation has taken a new twist in the last couple of years. And what we're learning now is that the air pollution that you might experience as a child, for instance, or even pre-birth, might cause a permanent sort of impairment for the rest of your life. So we've been studying kids in East London, and we've studied several thousand, and we've measured the size of their lungs. And we found that kids that are in the most polluted places are growing smaller lungs. Now, this might not be a problem for them now, because it's only a small difference, unless they want to go up to be Mo Farah or some sort of, you know, athlete or something like that. But if you think about the older people in your family and about the end of their lives, you know, the last few years of people's lives are often full of a struggle for breath and diseases and coughing and things like that. So if people enter that time with smaller lungs, then it's going to be very difficult and their life chances are not as good.
One of the things that you alluded to earlier in our conversation and that you write about in your book is indoor air pollution. And that's also something that we tend to separate from global air pollution risks that come from things like factories. How important is it for us to take on this issue of indoor air pollution? How deadly is it?
We don't know so much about indoor air pollution. It's quite a fragmented area of science. But we do know that the things that we do in our home do cause pollution. And this is changing quite a bit as well. And I assume it's the same in the US, but there's a big push towards making our houses more energy efficient. I live in quite an efficient, energy efficient house. That means it doesn't have many drafts. So the products that we use in our home, from deodorants to our inkjet in our printer to our cooking and so forth, stay in our home longer, and this can cause us harm. We're also seeing an interesting change whereby we've controlled certain pollutants, certain sort of solvents and organics from industry and from traffic and so forth. So for some things that cause summertime smogs, the single biggest source now is the products that we use in our homes rather than our traffic and factories.
Now, is there a large enough overlap between the impacts of industry that are triggering climate change and those that cause that result in air pollution? Because one of the things that, you know, one of the big fights of our generation now is, of course, to prevent our planet from warming. Do you feel that the fight against air pollution can feed into the fight against climate change?
We've been fighting air pollution for much longer than we've been fighting climate change. You know, we've been fighting air pollution for 70, 80 years. We've been fighting climate change for just a couple of decades. And the two agenda are not very well joined together. And some of the things that we've done to help climate change have not been good for air pollution and vice versa. So, for instance, you can think of increasing home wood burning. People say, OK, that's good for climate. But it's pretty disastrous for urban air pollution. And similarly, there's issues with diesel vehicles, for which Europe has quite a lot. This was sold to us wrongly, actually, that it would help climate change, but it's been very bad for air pollution. So our real challenge going forward is how to get both agenda to help each other. So for instance, you talked about coal earlier. Coal is bad for air pollution. It's bad for climate change as well. So something that introduces renewable energy rather than relying on fossil fuel and especially coal could help both ways. It could help us with climate change and it could help us with air pollution. There's other solutions as well. For instance, if we think about the way in which we travel around our cities, if we travel by car, or even if we swap this for an electric vehicle, then yeah, okay, that might help air pollution. But if we actually reduce the amount of car dependency in our cities, we could solve so many problems. We could help the climate change one, we could help the air pollution one. We could help with urban noise that plagues so many, and we could also help with many of the sort of chronic problems we have with just lack of exercise, you know, those of obesity, diabetes, heart problems that seem to plague many of our countries.
Finally, do you worry that the United States currently has taken a deregulatory approach of putting the health of the economy over the health of our environment and people? You know, the rolling back of aspects of the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts, and a presidency that is so largely focused on unfettering business and industry, could roll back not just efforts here in the US but even globally?
Yeah, I think it's a real problem. I think it's the wrong way to think about it, that the health of the population and the health of industry are somehow not connected. They are. So if people get ill through the effects of air pollution, then that increases taxes as well, doesn't it? So there's a connection there anyway. You can't separate those. But I worry also on a global scale as well. There's so much that the US has given us in terms of air pollution science that if we need that, the world needs America to be investing in this. For instance, we've got a lot of equipment at King's College where I work. And if I go into many of the laboratories and look behind the equipment, I'll see lots of signs that said made in the USA. So the battle that the US has fought for air pollution is good for US industry. But looking to the future, who is leading? You know, which countries are leading the battle for air pollution? And at the moment, it's China. They're making huge, huge efforts and getting huge results in controlling their air pollution. And that involves developing technologies which they will then sell on to others. So if the US isn't part of this, it's really going to miss out.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Gary Fuller, in discussing your new book. Thanks so much. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Dr. Gary Fuller, an air pollution scientist at King's College in London. He writes the Pollution Watch series for The Guardian. We've been discussing his new book. It's called The Invisible Killer, The Rising Global Threat of Air Pollution and How We Can Fight Back. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.